Actually, before I start, I would like to express my appreciation for the organization of this wonderful meeting. It's very enjoyable. And I was asked to talk about the relation between the merger transition and the Chopik phenomena. But I thought that would be too much, going too fast to something very specific. So I wanted to start with a discussion, with a broad discussion of challenges for phase transitions in general relativity. And I will just have a few points. I will start with some general comments. Then there are two systems, the black hole, black string, and the ring. And then some comments about numerical relativity. So this will be from a personal perspective. Okay, so roughly, GR can be divided into three parts, right? Black holes, cosmology, and waves. And here we're going to concentrate on black holes, because they will exhibit the most interesting phenomena, perhaps, or at least one of the interesting phenomena, when you go to higher dimensions. And basically, we have two examples, right, for non-uniqueness in higher dimensions. The first, did we have a scale pointer?
There should be a laser pointer down here.
It should be a laser pointer? Ah, let's see. This thing.
Several of those things should be the red beams of light.
This one.
Yeah, it's right.
Great. Okay. Thank you. Okay.
Yes.
So, in the presence of a compact dimension, we can either have black holes. Okay, we can either have black holes, or we can have black objects which extend from one side to the other, that wind the extra dimension, and then we call it a black string. So these are two different horizon topologies, and they can exist for the same value of the mass. Therefore, we have non-uniqueness.
Similarly,
for rotating black holes, we may have either rotating black holes which are spherical or ring-like solutions which are rotating. And again, this happens for the same values of mass and angular momentum. We should distinguish perhaps between two properties. I'm calling that non-uniqueness. And in four dimensions, we have two properties which are closely related: uniqueness and no hair, or maybe you can call it no memory. So what is the difference that I want to make? And I don't know if it's standard. I think it's pretty standard, but in four dimensions, the distinction is not very important because we have both of them. So no hair, I want to call the property that the black hole is determined by a small number of perhaps conserved asymptotic parameters. And uniqueness is the property that, given these asymptotic parameters, there is a unique solution rather than a discrete set. So here, obviously, uniqueness is broken. And actually, we know from the work of the ring, let's see. So the uniqueness is broken, violated, and the no hair depends how do you want to define it. We know that the rings are parameterized by quantities which are not conserved, but rather by dipole moments. So if you define it with the word conserved, then no hair is also violated. But if you leave out the word conserved, then this principle continues to exist. It's a small number of parameters measured from infinity.
But then you have to define what you mean by small.
Well, you can, a star in general would be characterized by all its mass moments, all the matter that is in it, the various kinds of matter, each matter, you know, the various elements maybe. So there are tons and tons of infinities of parameters that you have to give in order to fully specify a star, say. Okay? So as long as it's less than a few infinities, then I call it small. Okay? In this case, it is 7 or 9, right? But you're right, there could be a greater.
Did you propose a definition?
a number of parameters which is not scaled with the size of the object.
I think that's always the case. But
wait, I guess you have atoms.
If you have atoms, if you have atoms, you mean? Because you count the individual atoms. Okay. Okay. Yeah, I was taking it as infinite. I was allowing an infinite number of multiples, but you're right. It's fine. Okay.
If you're not, if you remove the word conserved,
yes,
might we still have uniqueness as well?
Uniqueness is obviously lost because of these two examples in higher dimensions. Uniqueness is obviously lost, violated. Okay? Because you give here the mass and the angular momentum, and you have two solutions.
No, if you give the higher dipole moments as well.
Maybe I misunderstood the question.
So I didn't. You refined the notion of no hair right, to introduce a parameter that distinguishes between the black hole and the black ring.
No. The additional parameters are continuous parameters, such as the dipole charges. Okay, these I'm willing to introduce. I'm not willing to introduce discrete parameters. This is exactly the issue of uniqueness. So you have a manifold of solutions. And the question is, here is the manifold of solutions, and here is perhaps the asymptotic charge. So the question is whether it's one-to-one or not. Okay, so a manifold like this would be unique, would have the uniqueness property, while a manifold like this does not have the uniqueness property. Okay, but if both manifolds have a finite dimension, namely a small number of parameters. Okay?
But so, I guess I'm still confused. If I specify the dipole moment, can't I distinguish between the original black hole and black ring?
But it's not a continuous parameter. You cannot, it's not an additional parameter that you can insert, you see?
You're saying the black ring doesn't have an arbitrary
or the black hole.
Well,
let's, in the original case there are no charges, so maybe we should stick to the original case. There are no charges, so then you have to add something else.
So you could add, for instance,
the quadrupole mass moment, right? But the quadrupole mass moment is not a continuous parameter that you can dial and you will have one more parameter. There are only two parameters to this family of solutions, not three.
Okay, so the basic distinction between your no hair and uniqueness is, in one case you allow a discrete choice, in the other case you're not allowing discrete input. Is that right?
I think so. I think we got to
you
the
point. No, if I specify that it's a ring, then I know it has no hair.
No hair means that whatever fell into it, it forgot. It just remembers seven or three or two parameters, okay? That's what it means. So a lot of things could have fallen into it, but it remembers only two parameters or seven. This is what I mean by no hair. Now the question of uniqueness is whether, given the stuff that fell into it, do you know what will form or you don't?
Okay. No hair is the space of solutions in one-dimensional map.
Yes.
Uniqueness is the asymptotic charges are good coordinates on that one-dimensional map.
This is a good discussion. Maybe we should postpone it to later, but hopefully we've exhausted it a little. So the main point that I wanted to make is that non-uniqueness allows for phase transitions, because you have two phases with the same asymptotic charges, either here or here. And that's something completely new in general relativity. In four dimensions, we don't have this property. So phase transitions we're used to are very exciting physical events. There's a lot of energy released. In this case, there will be issues of singularities. Because we're talking about black holes, these are the densest form of matter. Everything is happening with the speed of light, so there's a lot of power ejected in such events. So they're very interesting. Yes.
And you said that there are phase transitions, I mean, you can have phase transitions also where you generate a continuous non-conserved parameter. From what you said, that you got the idea that you were talking about transitions between
objects
that are characterized by discrete.
I agree. As long as it's not conserved, you already have phase transitions. On that, I agree. Okay? Yeah. Well, we have to decide what we call no hair. I left an option whether you want to call it with a conservative or not, so I don't know what is other people's preference.
When you're saying no hair or no memory, you're thinking of something that's defined at infinity.
Right.
Right, so you're really saying that any other thing that falls off more rapidly.
A dipole charge, right? That's the question. It's not conserved. You can measure it at infinity, but it's harder. So this is something that we didn't have in four dimensions, but now we have in five. Okay? Okay. So what are the central challenges in my opinion? Well, during these phase transitions, there's a good chance for a violation of cosmic censorship. Now, I think we all know what cosmic censorship is, and it's considered to be probably the most important open conjecture of general relativity. So it's certainly something worthwhile. Why do we expect that it will be violated in this case? Well, the naive picture goes like this. We have a string, there's a singularity inside, then the string starts decaying because of the Gregory-Laplan instability. And then at some point, the horizon touches on the singularity, and the singularity breaks and pinches. At that moment, the singularity would be naked. So that's the naive picture. And notice that this violation is generic. So there are other violations which are not generic, but here you can start with a string or with something very close to it, it doesn't matter. You have some open subset of the initial condition. Possibility. So it is generic. It exposes short-scale Planck physics, perhaps. Doesn't matter with what you started. If you start with very large objects, that you finally get there. And you may get shockwaves out of this event. Why would you get shockwaves? Well, like any instability, there's a tachyon that is running downhill, and energy is emitted. So energy is emitted, so certainly there are some gravitational waves going to infinity. Perhaps they are singular, perhaps not, we don't know. But the picture would be something like this. There's an explosion, something tears up, and the wave is going outside to infinity. So you can call it a thunderbolt, if you like. There's another... I can call it a mathematical alternative, namely that the snake that connects the two sides of the black hole doesn't disconnect. How could that happen? Well, physically, it's clear that this process starts, explodes, and within finite time, you can go there and visit, and you'll just see a black hole. Okay. I can't imagine any other thing. But mathematically, within classical GR, we can imagine that the radius goes to zero, but in infinite asymptotic time. So the question is whether that happens in infinite asymptotic time or in finite asymptotic time. For instance, it could go exponentially fast to zero. And in that case, classical cosmic censorship would be saved. So we don't know whether the situation is that cosmic censorship is violated or not, but this is clearly a very interesting question.
T is an external time or proper time?
So T would be the asymptotic time at infinity. And then there is a discussion that maybe we'll get to in a moment that it's probably true that it takes infinite horizon time anyway. But it looks from the simulations like it's taking finite or close to finite asymptotic time. Okay? There are two other important notions, to my opinion, that we'll discuss in a moment, which are critical dimensions and topology change. These were, to a certain extent, surprises, and I think there's still interesting things to learn about these points. Okay, so now let's say a few words about the two systems, the black hole black string and the ring system. So, let's see. So here is the phase diagram that encodes I think, the state of the art with respect to the black hole black strain transition. So what do we see here? Let's start with this picture. First, there is a critical dimension that we'll discuss in a moment. Let's think about it for a moment, it's 13 and a half. So for low enough dimensions, the picture here on the left-hand side. What do we see here? This axis is the dimensionless mass of the object. So it may be either a string or a black hole. It has a mass, and we can divide it by powers of the size of the extra dimension to get something dimensionless. This axis measures the non-uniformity of this object. It is a B is defined, okay, I think we... B is defined as the asymptotic behavior of GZZ, the size of the extra dimension, like so. Okay? So the uniform strings have B equals to zero, or zero non-uniformity, as they lie here. This is the black hole. And this is the non-uniform strain, which emerges from the Gregory-Laplanck point. And it was conjectured by me some time ago that these two lines should meet based on a conservation of phase rule, which I will not go into detail now. And in these numerical simulations, many of the people who were involved are here or were here, created a very similar picture. So I'm just, the black string is this uniform string, NUS, non-uniform string, these branches here, up to the X, and the black hole is from here on. Blue is stable phases, and red dash is unstable phases. Okay? So this is the phase diagram of this system. And surprisingly, it was discovered by Evgeny, who's also here, that for dimensions 14 and larger, the phase diagram is expected to change. Instead of having a first order transition, a violent transition where the unstable string collapses and forms a black hole, here it is a second order transition, it's a smooth transition. It pops and makes a slightly non-uniform stable string. Okay, so it's something different. And it turns out that this critical dimension even depends on whether you use microcanonical ensemble or canonical ensemble, namely whether you put it in a heat bath or not. So if it's in a heat bath, then it happens one dimension less. My D here is total space-time dimension, including time, including the extra dimension.
How do you know it's stable? You said it's stable.
Yes, so not all of the details on this diagram were confirmed. In particular, the stability was not confirmed, but the reasons that we understand these come again from the topological theory of how phases are allowed to change into another. So we know that phases are allowed to change, something happens also to their stability. So this is how we can predict what will be the stability, even though, for instance, the stability of this branch was not determined, which I think was your point, right?
You say above 13 and a half dimensions should be stable.
Right.
Uniform.
There it wasn't even constructed.
Right.
Yet.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So, of course, it wasn't observed directly stability, but this is the stability to be expected.
So it was constructed for Drubet,
right? Right. So just around here, it was constructed just around here.
So we have a question. You talk about stability in the canonical ensemble.
Right.
Are you talking about the dynamic stability?
Okay. No. So if we're in the canonical ensemble, you found here a finer detail. It's true, even Schwarzschild is unstable, right? So you have to add one to each, to the number of instabilities. So if you take this picture in the canonical picture, then this would be one unstable mode, and this would be two. Okay?
But you are counting thermodynamic stabilities or instabilities?
I'm counting perturbative stabilities, instabilities. I'm counting perturbative instabilities. Okay,
perturbative meaning dynamical instabilities.
Right.
What does it mean when I'm talking about dynamical instabilities and talking about using the canonical ensemble or putting it in the classical geo?
So
Sam, can you explain your question a little bit more? I mean, I heard the words, but I think I didn't understand what you're...
Yeah, I think I can explain his question. He asked what is the technical difference between doing perturbations in the canonical and the microcanonical ensemble. And in both cases, what you're doing, you're looking at the eigenvalues of the Lichnerowitz operator, but actually slightly different, I believe. In one of them, you multiply it by GTP, and in the other, you do not. So I think that's correct, but maybe that we can respond later. So there is some technical detail which is different and allows for some differences.
That sounds like a dynamical definition. You're talking about zero modes or instabilities.
I'm talking about dynamical instabilities, right.
So then how does that, to make the connection with thermodynamics, that's in the Euclidean equation?
No one was talking about thermodynamics. It's true that they are connected.
My question was more along the lines of the bar. What does it mean when you say you're doing a dynamical problem in the canonical ensemble?
Then what do you mean by the canonical ensemble?
That was his words, and that was my question.
his answer
was that it somehow involves a slightly different Lichnerowitz operator,
right,
in a way that was not fully specified, and the physics of which is not yet transparent to me.
Okay. Yeah, fair enough.
I don't know how to phrase it in that case.
It is just a mixture.
I don't know. It's just a linear preservation.
I mean, I would understand what it means to do it, to look at stabilities of the Euclidean solution.
Yes, I think the Euclid, what you call instabilities of the Euclidean solution is pretty much what you would call the canonical one. This is what I mean. Yes, yes. If you like. And there you think about it differently. So in the Euclidean solution, you don't have time evolution. So in the usual microcanonical case, you put in the G, in the overall solution, e to the I omega t, right? And when you do Euclidean perturbations, you don't do that. The eigenvalue has a slightly different meaning. The eigenvalue of the Lichnerowitz. Yes, off shell, on shell.
What? I mean, that if you're going off shell, then that's not the, that's not the classical. That's not the
If you take the Euclidean black hole,
yes,
you can look at the spectrum of the Lichnerowitz operator, right?
Yes, really.
And for instance, the most important thing is the negative mode, which gives you exactly the critical length for this instability. So it definitely has a physical sense. Meaning. So let's see. So what do we want to say more about it? So there were numerical simulations by the group in Jerusalem, by Kudo and Weissman. There was analytic work about how small black holes look. That's this branch over here. By Trolls and Nils over here, and by our group, and recently there was an interesting paper by Chu Goldberger and Rothstein. I think the situation by now, there was some controversy what happens with the end state of the decay from here. This picture seems to indicate that this is the only possible answer, and I think by now there is a near consensus, almost consensus, that this is what is going to happen, so it will end up in a black hole. Somehow, maybe should be. The focus a little bit. Yes. Okay. And I want to explain that in the time evolution of this process where the string decays, there we do not expect to see any cones. So later we'll talk about a lot about cones. But I heard the remark in the previous talk that we expected some cones in the time evolution, but that's not the case. The cones are expected, as we'll see, in some static solutions. Okay, and now the focus of the next talk, of the next part of the talk, will be this X. What is this X? This X is the point where on the one side we have black strings, highly non-uniform, and on the other side we have black holes, which are almost self-intersecting. So this is what I call a merger transition. This, if you go from this side, you see the two poles of the black hole merging, whereas if you go from this side, you could call it pinching. Okay.
So your red line contingent, so you expect the stability and stability to change over time? Or at
yes.
its cost?
It should be changing at the top, and it's a slightly open question whether the top is where the x is or not. Is that your question?
Yeah, but I thought Tokyo's results show that it turned around all the way.
So it looks numerically, it looks like the way it's written. But the stability should change at the top.
Because they have topology arguments?
Yes. Yeah. It's actually something simple, but we don't have the time right now. Yeah, so when the black hole will be large enough, there will be again an explosion and an instability, and it will decay into a string. This is the picture. Okay, so I promised to say a few words about critical dimensions and topology change. So critical dimension, we already saw one incident of critical dimension, namely this 13.5 or 12.5 when the transition turns from first order to second order. There's also another critical dimension of 10, which we'll see later, which has to do with cone stability. There are certain solutions of cones whose stability changes as you go below or above 10. And of course, we can compute all these critical dimensions, but we don't have any understanding of whether they have any deeper meaning or not. Of course, this one is very close to the critical dimension of string theory, but it looks like a complete coincidence. Topology change. Okay, so this again we'll see in a moment in more detail. So actually I'm willing to skip this. I think when we see that in more detail it will be clearer. But this is an important issue that I would just want to enumerate at the moment. And I want to enumerate a few more technical issues. We know that the black hole, Schwarzschild black hole, has exactly one negative mode. That's the basis for the Gregory-Laflamme instability. It was discovered by Gross, Terry, and Yaffe, I think, in 86. But there is, to this day, in my opinion, there is still no simple derivation of it. Simple enough, for instance, in the sense that you can show why it had to be exactly one mode. Not physically, but mathematically. So just looking at the equations and before doing anything numeric, saying, oh, this must be exactly one negative mode. As far as I know, there is no way to just look at them and tell that. Is that their statement? Okay.
Is there a reason why there should be a reason?
Yes, because it's very important physically. Physically, it's very important that there is one, because then, for instance, the decay of hot space, which is mediated by the Euclidean black hole, it's important to calculate the determinant of the fluctuations. And since you have exactly one negative mode, that means the determinant is negative. Of course, if you had an odd number, it would still be true. And then the square root is imaginary, and that tells you that the correction is not corrections to the energy, but actually to the decay time of this hot space. Okay, so this is one way. Therefore, I think that physically it's important.
Okay. If you can have any other modes.
As I said, yes. But
it's similar to the Chirpy phenomena, but usually they feel one unstable mode.
Okay. So I would. I'm hopeful that a textbook proof for this number, for this critical length, or this negative eigenvalue, its equivalent, will be found. Regarding the ring, I'm not an expert, but I want to ask a question that people usually do not ask. I would like to know what is the phase transition physics. For instance, we know that if you take the black hole or the singularity transition, the singularity structure, sorry. And what for instance, we could look at. Previously, we looked and we saw that there was a merger transition. There was a big enough black hole turning into a non-uniform string. In the ring, we also know something similar happens. If you take the black hole and rotate it strong enough, then in the limit, it is equivalent to a ring which is fat enough. In certain senses, it is equivalent, although they look somewhat different. But they are very, very singular, both of them. For instance, both of them have zero area. So this is a highly rotating black hole, which is actually pancake. And this is a very fat black ring, which I suppose its inner disk shrinks to zero. But in what sense these two are the same, it's not clear. But next, around this point, there's again a second order phase transition physics, presumably. And there are various other questions of phase transition physics we can ask. The first of them is probably the stability issue. Which ones are stable and which ones are not? We know that there are rings which are stable because they're BPS. We probably know that the original rings, the ones which were uncharged, are unstable. And then it's a very interesting question, which ones are stable, which ones are not, and what makes the onset of instability. Okay, these are open questions, of course they're not so easy to determine, but it's good to keep some big questions also in mind. Also, I think there are other issues that people are that are interesting and people are working on, completing the solution space. So we have 7 parameter rings, but we expect that there are more, whether there are rings in dimensions higher than 5, whether you can rotate the ring, the original ring, with 2 angular momenta. So the original ring, I remind you, had only 1 angular momentum, but 5 dimensions, you can have 2 angular momenta. Okay? So this is the phase transition outlook on the rings. Finally, a few words on numerical relativity. So numerical relativists view their central problem to be the black hole merger. You have a binary star of 2 black holes, binary system of 2 black holes, and they spiral into each other, and you want to know what is the signature of gravity waves that is being emitted from this system. Now, Luis is not here, and he's also formally not at this meeting at all. And I want to argue that this should probably change in the not too distant future, because it seems that this problem is running out. There is numerical progress, and not less importantly, there is theoretical progress on solving this problem. So I think it would be very interesting to look at other problems that could stimulate numerical relativity. And I think we can offer a few problems. So, time evolution of the instability. Right now, it has limitations, and there are various ways to improve it. We could do things which are more modest than full time evolution. For instance, start with a dimension greater than 14, and then you have a relatively short evolution because the uniform unstable string is expected to run to a slightly non-uniform but stable string. So this should be something relatively easy to do numerically. And the easier part is the stability analysis. You plug in some metric and you let it just start evolve. And you can tell immediately whether it's stable or not if you see exponential time dependence or not, right? So if you see exponential time dependence, that tells you already in short times whether the solution is stable. So all these various things that we discussed, like the non-uniform string that makes sense, or the large black hole that Henry has, or the ring which we just mentioned, you could plug in these metrics, hopefully, and maybe the numerical answer could be easier to obtain than the analytic one. And there's also numerical challenges having to do with the cone structure, which I will discuss in the next part. Okay, so here we outlined several numerical challenges that that could be attacked in this field. And I think that since now the number of workers in numerical relativity on these problems is relatively low, the field is relatively easy to enter and young, and it should be relatively easy to obtain or to reach new results. Okay, so this is the end of part one. If there is discussion, we can, what? Yes, good, we can have a picture of my eldest, and yes.
When you say easy, what is your, is what you compare?
Relatively easy to enter the field?
No, to find a solution. Solve the numerical problem.
I didn't say that it is easy to solve the numerical problem. It's a very difficult problem. No, it's a very difficult and worthwhile problem. I said, I think my only point was that now that the number of workers in the field, most of numerical relativists are involved in the binary merger, as Luis told us, therefore it is relatively, you know, there is less competition, so it's relatively easy to enter and to make contributions with sense. What?
My contribution is to solve something.
Yes. For instance, to attack one of these problems.
Okay.
Maybe. Yes. Yes. I suppose it is. Okay, let's see. Can anyone ask a question that has to do with this? Okay,
how old is the child that was?
This was 2 years ago, so now she's 4.
And the oldest? She's the oldest?
Yes. She's the eldest. Okay. So if there are no further questions about this part, we'll wait a moment, then I'll go to the other part, which will be a blackboard. More slow pace, and we can follow the development of the idea. Yes.
If you consider the black screen and black hole system, turbo law, right? So because the black holes, let's say in 5 dimensions, okay, below the data point five, right? They're not entropically preferable. Let's say black holes are entropically preferable over black string for some finite region of masses above
I think this is a comment, not a question. It's true that in this phase transition, if we go back, phase diagram, sorry, where is our phase diagram? In this phase diagram, we have several interesting points. We have this point, which is the point where the string decays perturbatively by attacking to here. We have another point here where the black hole is large, so large that the tachyon appears and it wants to decay to a string. This is a point which we don't know precisely, but we expect from the form of the diagram. And there is an intermediate point over here, which is before the instability sets. That's a point where already thermodynamically the areas are the same. So if you wait long enough, already at that point, it will tunnel thermodynamically by thermodynamic fluctuations from one solution to the other. Okay, so here we see a typical hysteresis curve, which is typical to first order transitions. You can get the thermodynamic transition if you wait long enough, but if you continue to change the parameter before the thermodynamic transition happens, you will be forced for the to make the transition by a perturbative dynamic instability. So I was just discussing the issue that you raised.
ask you a simple question. Would you consider a canonical ensemble for black string situation? Suppose the mass of the black hole is even zero, but temperature non-zero, and you have a tube filled with the thermal gas. So in this case, it will be a self-consistent solution, will be not static. So either you put some boundary condition, finite size.
So when we talk usually about the canonical ensemble, I think of the heat bath as being outside.
Yes, outside. But in this space, if you have this thermal matter, mm-hmm. in the space-time, it will be provide some evolution of this space-time. It will not be static. Usually, in order to make it static, you put some boundary condition close to the black hole and keep this. So, do you consider any boundary condition?
Okay, I'm not sure if I understand. What you usually have, you take a black hole, yeah. And then you put a thermal gas with the temperature of the Hawking temperature,
yes,
and then there is equilibrium.
It will be unstable.
Infinity, right?
No, it's unstable. It's
well, the gas itself will be unstable.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So you need to keep boundary conditions some kind of distance from the black hole.
Okay.
So the scheme under something similar, you cannot go infinitely far from the black hole along the tube, so you need to boundary conditions some kind of distance.
I suppose whatever happens to the ordinary black holes, if you want to be careful, then you should do it here. In normal cases, the canonical ensemble is not, I think, is not the physical case, right? So usually we think of the microcanonical ensemble where it's not in a, in any heat bath. Okay. So, John, how do we lift this up and just try the back one? So now I want to discuss something, not only challenges and words, but some physics. So quick. Saving and merger condition. And the outline of what I'll try to say will be first to review what I call the merger condition, which I mentioned already. Then to review briefly the Chopwith scaling. I suppose many of you know a lot, but maybe some would appreciate the review. Motivate the relation. Discuss the relation in detail, discuss the action, the boundary conditions, the stability, and finally implications. Okay. Okay, so what do I mean by the merger condition? On the phase diagram, it was the point that we just saw where the non-uniform string meets a black hole. So on this side, it's a string, and on this side, it's a black hole. How do both sides look like if I look close to this point? On the string side, it looks like a very thin neck. So, this is how it looks like. On the other side, it looks like the two poles of the black hole almost self-intersecting. And now there is an important topological observation that we need to make. We'll see that actually these two spaces have different topologies. And now I'm not talking about horizon topology, that's obvious, but I'm talking about space-time topology. Since these two spaces are static, all these solutions in the phase diagram are static. We're looking only at static solutions because in order to draw phase diagrams, that's all you're interested in. You can, since they're static, you can analytically continue T to IT, and then immediately you get Euclidean spacetimes. And the topology of these two Euclidean spacetimes is different, as we'll see in a moment. How do we see that? I look at some surface far away from the neck. It could be either here or here, it doesn't matter, because this surface cannot change very much as we go through the transition. Its topology cannot change. So I remind you that in Euclidean black holes, there is nothing inside the black hole. So the black hole is actually only here on the outside. Okay? And then the question is, what is the topology of this surface? So there is one factor which is easy to understand. So topology of this line is the following. Each point here, oh, maybe I should, I'm not sure if these pictures are self-explanatory or not. I think they pretty much are. I'm not drawing here the angular direction, right? So if we are in a, so suppose this is a fifth dimension, which I denote by Z, then I'm not showing here time, I'm showing the radial coordinate, but each point here is a two-sphere, okay? So this two-sphere is of course part of the topology of this line. So in general, it would be S D minus 3. Now, we have to remember actually there's also time fibers over each point here. And time vibrations have the property that they exactly vanish on the horizon, right? That's the definition of a horizon. So that means that we have a line, it circles fibers over it in such a way that they vanish at the end. So what is this space? It's not visible, I think. So let's draw it up here. So I have an interval with circles of time which shrink on the side because the side is the horizon. Okay? So what is this space? This space is an S2. Thank you. So therefore, the topology of this object is SD minus 3 cross S2. Now let's look about the total topology. So that was the topology of this slice, which is by the same argument also the topology of this boundary over here. Now what happens as we go inside? We gotta make some room over here. On this side, we see that the angular sphere never shrinks. It has a minimal size, which is the minimal width of the neck. So I can draw it in such a way. This would be SD minus 3. And the SD minus 2 shrinks, because you see that this S2 here becomes of zero size. Here, on the other hand, the SD minus 3 completely shrinks, because it is the angular sphere, and on axis here, the axis is exposed in the black hole phase, so it completely shrinks. And on this side, the pyramid looks like this. So this is, this was supposed to be S2, right? So here I have the S2 at the end having a finite size. This is the S2 of finite size. And the SD minus 3 shrinks completely. Okay? So obviously these two spaces have a different topology. This is the different space-time topology in the Euclidean case that I was discussing. I think this is the main point to understand what this merger is about. And then there is a natural suggestion to how to connect the two if you have a metric which is singular in both directions. So here I would write like this. This is the intermediate step that you need in order to go from here to here. Of course, this is a singular space. You cannot change topology without going through some singular point, without going through some singular configuration.
Yes. You're stressing the Euclidean topology, but I would have thought the Lorentzian topology in these two Lorentzian solutions would be different too, right?
Probably. Then you look at the, but then we discuss slices and becomes more messy, so I wanted to show the simplest thing.
It's not that much more messy. I mean, your SD minus 3 is still not contractible in the black string solution, even the Lorentzian solution.
If you consider the space outside the black string.
No, I mean if I consider the whole space time.
Well, are you going to look at the slice at the, some given time, or are you going to look at all of space time?
All of space time.
You're assuming the solutions have a little bit of probability, like a collapse or something.
Yeah, I was thinking of some that it maps to the extent of the trunk of black string space.
Yeah, that's probably true.
It's like a confused box for the
what is confusing?
I thought like the normal black though just have topology R squared plus that squared now.
Mm-hmm.
So the string that even if it's not uniform is going to have the same topology as black.
Cross
the
surface one.
So
in your net language is R squared plus
S1 plus S2.
S1 plus S2.
Yes, so let's see. So let's see how it works here, okay?
Cross S3.
Right, so what are these S2
cross S3? Let's see how it works here, okay? So you're right. So
is S2 is a different 2 sphere, which appears in the Euclidean solution. But if you think that SD minus 3 that he's talking about is the S2 you're thinking.
Right, so that's the angular pieces. Yeah. So where's this other S2 then?
When it's fine, it doesn't go all the way around the circle.
So in the Euclidean solution, your R2 becomes the cigar.
Yeah.
And if I have a natural slice, it's natural to slice that in polar coordinates, and you have an S1.
But it's still R2.
And he's arguing that in the solution near the boundary, that S1 becomes fibered over the interval to make an S2.
Sorry,
but the interval comes.
Give me a shot. Let's see it step by step, okay? So if I just look at the black hole, then you would say that the Euclidean solution has S2, which is angular, cross R2, which is made out of R and time.
Yeah.
Right? Now, if it's a black string, then it would be very similar. It would be S2 omega cross R RT cross S1. R2, S1 for the Z direction, right? Now what do we see here? This SD minus 3 is the same as this S omega. Now this direction, S2, is an S2 which shrinks, okay? So there's now an additional direction, okay? So S2 cross SD minus 3 is the topology of the basis of this pyramid. Now I want to look, okay, it's just this
but
boundary.
Topology doesn't care about metrics. Topology is doesn't care about distances. You know?
Of course. But this product is the topology of the boundary of this space, right? It's not the total space. We also have this coordinate, which I'm drawing now here. Okay? So this space is denoted in this diagram as the basis of the pyramid. Okay? This space is the basis of this pyramid. S, this angular sphere times this S2, which I explained coming from time. Okay? In addition, we have here another coordinate. This coordinate. And this coordinate in the pyramid is the height of the pyramid. Okay, so you have to add this coordinate to the topology. So the topology of the total space of this pyramid is total topology, SD minus 3 cross R3. Why R3? Because you have an S2 which shrinks to zero size with an extra dimension. So this is exactly the radial representation of R3. Okay? The radial representation of R3 means that you take a family of two spheres, and in this way, you reproduce R3.
So I don't see where that's coming from R3 across this one.
No, it's localized. No, because here I'm not looking at the whole. Here I didn't take it, didn't care it about the periodicity. So actually, as far as we're concerned now, this is actually R. And now you have agreement.
I think it's right.
It's local topology, yes?
Yes, it's local topology.
It's local topology.
Okay? So the local topology around here is this. This is exactly the global topology, but if you look in some around some point, then locally it's just R3. Okay, this is a nice word. So locally around any point here, it's just R3. Locally, it's R3. So on both sides, in this picture and in what you expect, you get the same things. Okay. So if there's a specific question, I'm willing to stay on this point because it's an important point. Otherwise,
we all agree there is a difference.
We can continue.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Great. Okay.
So, sorry about that. So before you move that out, so is the total topology in both cases the same?
No, it's not. Here, the S2 is non-contractible. Here the S2 is non-contractible,
yeah.
While here the angular sphere is non-contractible. Okay, so these two pyramids have different local topology.
No,
we're not talking about the local topology. So these two pyramids have different topology. Okay, that's why it's a topology change of the total space-time locally. Okay, and you have to go through here.
But in fact, is there any way in which we're changing the two spheres?
In five dimensions, it is symmetrical. This sphere and this sphere has the same dimension.
Can you learn anything from this? Say that you exchange one sphere for another.
When you look at the equations, which
the
yes, when you look at the equations, there is an additional two symmetry, indeed.
No, when I say that, what the argument said that you're kind of changing the two spheres topologically.
Yeah.
Medically, I don't think that you're doing that.
Right. Right, because this sphere, the angular sphere is always round, while the S2 is not necessarily round. Here. Okay, it's not necessarily round. That's true. So, on the face of it, at least, it's not symmetric. But I will claim that it's not clear actually to this moment whether this other S2 is spherical or not. But originally, it doesn't have to be. Okay.
So I just have a comment.
Yes.
This looks exactly as this plot transition people
yes.
discussed.
It's called the conic plot transition. Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't want to say it because some of the people it just confuses them. So then they ask me, so what is the conic plot? So I don't want to answer that. Okay. Yeah, it could be 5 and up. So I tell what are the differences since I was asked. Here it could be 5 and up. In the conifold, it's only 6. In the conifold case, these are supersymmetric spaces, namely spaces with killing spinners. Here it's not. They're all rich flat spaces, but they're not EPS. They don't have killing spinners. Okay? So you go one dimension lower, maybe, but you lose on the stability.
So back in the middle point for the cone, mm-hmm. If you have two spheres, are they the same two spheres? Are they both round then?
Not necessarily, at least. But in a moment, maybe they'll be. But not necessarily. Topologically, not necessarily. From the symmetries of the problem and from the topology, not necessarily. Okay, so now we drew pictures and there are a lot of people that prefer equations. I will write very simple equations, but I will try to write down how does the metric look like in this case. So the metric, we first have to identify the symmetries. So we have these symmetries, which are angular symmetries. The symmetry is not B minus 2. So this is the symmetry of this here, of this S B minus 3, cross time translation, since we have, since these are static solutions. Maybe more precise. Cross, there's another symmetry that we might need to use, which is a reflection symmetry. Right? It's top and down, both here and here are symmetric. So there's a reflection symmetry, a discrete symmetry, which is a Z2 related to the Z coordinate, to the coordinate in the extra dimension. If I want to write the most general metric with this symmetry, is the following method. Dx squared equals to e to the 2a dt squared. I'm writing it already Euclidean, but it doesn't matter. I can freely
exchange the
sign here plus to minus. Plus some metric in the Rz 2 plane, which is the 2 plane that we're drawing, plus something that measures the size of the spheres. So this is the Sb minus 3. So this metric has three fields, one and one. So altogether I have five fields, which are functions of R and Z in 2D plane. Okay? So if I now write the equations of motion, I will get five equations. I will have also to choose a gauge in this plane. So I have some freedom to eliminate some functions. But in the end, I will get five equations, five partial differential equations in the RZ plane. So this will be the equation side of this story. And one such solution will be the solution that I think Henriette was asking. I can easily write one solution. The solution that I can write is the following. Maybe I should define the coordinates. So here I had R and Z. It's convenient also to work with some kind of a radius coordinate, rho and chi. Okay? So this is I think it's clear how I define it. Just radial coordinates in the plane. Okay, so chi is the angle from the axis and rho is the distance from the x, from the apex to any point. So then you can write the following metric, and I will write it with all the factors even. Okay, so what is this metric? This is what I call a double cone. It is a cone because you have here d rho squared plus rho squared times something which is independent of rho. And it's a cone over a product of spheres. So it's a double cone, it's a cone over round S2 cross round Sb minus 3. So here I'm taking round S2. And these coefficients, are their exact value is important, they make it Ricci flat. Okay? So this is exactly a space with this topology, and the only singular point is rho equals to 0.
So you're trying to model this this transition locally, and you're not worrying about the periodicity in the z direction?
Right. I understand that in order to for this transition to happen, it must be possible to go through this topology change. And actually, it looked initially as a problem. for this, the picture of the phase diagram to be consistent, these two lines had to be connected. But this was an unknown topology change. So you had to show that there is some continuous one-parameter family of metrics which does this trick for you, which will be Ricci flat, not only topological, but Ricci flat metrics. Okay? So we're trying to solve in the equations and find this one-parameter family of solutions. Yeah. Okay. So this is a solution. One which is important to us. And we can also linearize around it. So if we linearize around it, we find something very interesting. So I linearize around it by inserting here e to the 2 epsilon over 2, where epsilon is a function of rho. And in principle, the coefficient here could have been another function of rho, but there's a constraint that relates them. So it's e to the minus 2 epsilon divided by d minus 3, it turns out. Okay? So then the question is this variation of the relative size of the two sphere, how do they change as a function of rho, as a function of the distance from the apex of the cone, which is the rho direction. And you find...
Sorry, how did you choose the factor of d minus 4, the relative normalization of the two in your...
By writing down the Einstein equations. This is, I think, the simple answer.
So you chose that to be Ricci flat measure.
Right. So otherwise, it will not be Ricci flat. The same way that you are familiar that if I do not have this factor, namely d equals to 3, this coefficient has to be exactly 1. Otherwise, you don't get flat space, right? So this is one special case that you know.
But does it have Kuhn-like singularity, some 0 equals 0, this one, the metric? Yeah. So this is the delta-like curvature, scalar curvature.
It's always singular. Unless one of the spheres is the zero sphere, it's always singular.
That's
1 point. Well, it's at 1 point, so I think you can think of it as a delta function curvature.
The curvature
will go to infinity. The Ricci is zero,
yes.
But the Kretschmann or something like this, because of the scaling property, once it's non-zero here, as you go here, it has to scale in an exact fashion with rho, so it will go to infinity. Everything will rescale. Yes. I didn't get to your question.
You're doing this, well, obviously, again, because in this case, you don't know precisely what the solutions are, but of course, in the case of a black ring and a black hole, you do know the solutions on both sides, and you should be able to play the same game and predict and analyze the.
Yes, but. Yeah, so this was one of my open questions. Here, it's clear. No, here, in this case,
yes.
you know at which point to, around which point to zoom.
Yes.
It's 1 point, and it's not that in the ring. I did think about it a little bit. Simon, for instance, knows, but it's you don't know exactly to which point to zoom because the whole solution becomes singular. It has zero area. So the question of how to zoom, you know, you have to say well, which coordinates you keep fixed and which ones you rescale in the process of zooming. It didn't work for me.
You're in better shape because you know the whole family of solutions.
That's right. That's right. I agree. This is a big advantage. But still, no one succeeded in doing that. Okay? So I'll be happy to discuss. Okay, so if you linearize around it, you get epsilon equals to
rho
to some powers. Because of the scale invariance, it can only be a power law, where this constant S12, is it below the line of sight?
It's
okay. Fine, okay. So up to here. Okay. So this is the dead region. Uh, So these exponents are determined only by the dimension, by the total dimension. That's true even if you divide the dimension differently, not 2 and b minus 3, but n and n. It's still true that these exponents depend only on the total dimension. And if you stare at it for a moment, you see that something special happens at b equals to 10. It turns from real to imaginary or otherwise. So there is a surprising critical dimension for the behavior here. Oh, this is the divergence. Okay. So epsilon is rho to this power. So it's the same as writing exponent of s times log of rho.
What's epsilon?
It's defined over here. It's the linearized perturbations which do not destroy the symmetries of both this sphere and this sphere. Okay. So the most general perturbation that you can make, and if you linearize it, you can solve the equations. And
If you write exponent of epsilon, it's not the same. So if exponent of epsilon is equal to rho, it will be the same as the exponent of logarithm rho. But here this.
So you want to know how e to the epsilon
looks
like?
Okay.
Well, because it's linearized, maybe that's what you need. Because it's linearized, then it's a small quantity, so the exponent of a small quantity is just a... We can probably sort it out later. It's this. It's what you expect. It's not different than what you expect.
What the two functions of epsilon you put in?
Right. I could have put two separate functions, and I'm doing that. I'll do that right now.
Oh, okay.
But there is also a constraint that comes from the Einstein equations, and in the linear level, this constraint tells you that these two functions are related like this. I think it's the Einstein rho rho, but I will not guarantee it.
So right. You don't solve all Einstein's equations, but just the constraints?
No, of course I solve all of them.
All of them?
Yes. Oh. Otherwise, I wouldn't be. Yeah.
But this whole parameter of the perturbation, the amplitude of perturbation.
What I mean is that I plug this into the equations and I retain only epsilons. I don't retain epsilon squares and higher. And I get some equations and I solve them.
This perturbation is still limited to a small parameter, right?
Yes. This function, epsilon, is the small function. So actually, from this you see that. Oh, here, sorry. You see that for large rho, because the real part is negative, for large rho, this epsilon is indeed small. So then it is trustable. While for, maybe this was your question, while for small rho, this diverges. So the linearized approximation is not trustable. Okay. Actually, we can do better. We can solve these equations, even the nonlinear equations, not analytically, but we can, let me just one more thing and then I'll come back to you. So we can actually do a little better. We can write the nonlinear equations. So there we, instead of this, we write e to the 2a of rho, and instead of this, we write e to the 2b of rho. And then we get some nonlinear equations for A and B, and we cannot solve them analytically, but we can solve them qualitatively. We can draw a phase diagram, and we know exactly how it looks like. And it turns out that except for this solution, there is basically only one solution, a single solution, additional, a single additional solution, which is smooth at the origin smooth, and up to scaling. And this solution is nothing but these smooth cones. It has this topology, namely, far away it's a double cone, but as you approach, one of the spheres closes in such a way, you know that a sphere, if it closes in the right way, can create a smooth space, right? So one of the spheres, say SD, for instance, IE, SD minus 3 is minimal size, so it's not shrinking. And the S2 will shrink to create R3. Gives R3 locally. Okay, so this is what I call a smooth cone. Smooth cone. Okay, so this is also a result of solving these ODEs, where we this time we assume dependence only on rho and not the full possible dependence on rho and on chi. So originally we had PDEs with two variables, and here we restrict to just dependence on this radial variable, the distance from the apex, and we get these possible solutions. Either the double cone with a singular apex, or a smooth cone, which is completely smooth. And of course, once you have such a solution, you can rescale it. So you get a family of solutions. So you can rescale it, and by rescaling it, actually, you can create a one-parameter family that approaches the cone, if you can imagine it, okay? If you take a smooth cone and you rescale it, then the tip becomes smaller and smaller and smaller, and in this way, you can get a one-family solution exactly as you wanted. It will take you from here or from here to here. And actually, it's also in finite distance in moduli space.
So you find both smooth solutions on either side as a perturbation of the singular.
Whether you want to call it perturbation, I don't know, but yes.
Right. And the other question I had is, what is the interpretation of what happens for d greater than 10?
For d greater than 10, you see that these exponents, instead of having an imaginary part, are two real exponents. That means that the fall of here, of the smooth cone, let's go over. Well, okay. How about here, is it okay? So if you look at the smooth cone, then the smooth cone will be close to the cone, but there will be a fall off. And if this imaginary part exists, there will be also oscillations. But if, right, because of the imaginary part in the exponent. Well, if not, then it will be just a smooth follow. That's the difference. So the it's the difference between the smooth cone and the double cone far away, whether it's oscillating or not, this difference. This is the issue.
When you said you solved equations qualitatively on your case, what exactly
did that mean? It means that you can draw in differential equations. Sometimes you can't write down the formula for the solution, but you can write all the possible trajectories, like which trajectories are, where are the attractor points, where are the saddle points, and map out all the possible trajectories of the equation. This is what I mean. So you know how it looks like. You know that far away it looks like a cone. You know that nearby it looks like a smooth space. There is no singularity. And you know that it exists. I think these are the basic three properties that I need. Okay? So this is what I meant by so it's a rigorous solution of the qualitative features. it's not a non-rigorous solution. Okay. So now, we are running out of time, I think. So I will not be able to go over everything. I will just try to say a couple of words about Chopwick scaling and why there is this relation at all. Okay, and we will leave the rest for some other time. So the Chopwick system is a system where you have you try to look at the threshold for creating a black hole. So how do you look at that? You would say, okay, let's send in, the simplest thing would be a spherical shell of matter, a spherical shell of matter. Let's send it in. If it is heavy enough, it will form a black hole. If it is too light, it will not form a black hole. And that's tuned this parameter of how much mass we're sending in, and we'll be able to hit the threshold for creation of black hole. Okay, so below the threshold, it will just go in, and everything will come out. And above the threshold, part of it will be reflected, but then a small part of it will create a black hole. And you would have liked to use the metric itself to be the matter that you collapse, but because of the spherical symmetry, you cannot actually create spherical gravitational waves because of the spin 2 property, so you have to add another field. So the experiment that you do is you take a scalar field. So you take the metric and a scalar field, and you discuss an initial condition where you prepare some wave packet which is spherically symmetric around some center, and you send it in. So you have some imploding shell, and you can imagine that the size of this imploding shell, so this is a profile of the phi field as a function of radius, say, and this size is a free parameter. You can change the size in the form in any way. And Chopwick found that this phenomena involves maybe two basic things. One is a scaling constant. There are some universal constants, two of them actually, delta and gamma, which tell you, which are independent, which are universal. What does it mean universally here? It means that it's independent of the family of initial conditions that you choose. It doesn't matter what initial conditions you choose, you always measure these same two numbers. We know how to measure them only numerically. We don't have a theoretical expression for them, or a analytic, maybe I should say, expression for them. And the other phenomenon is scaling. Why do we have a scaling phenomenon? Close to the, imagine the solution where the black hole just forms, where it's all of zero size. Then you lose all scales of the problem. And the solution is scale invariant, meaning that very close to the singularity, it repeats itself indefinitely each time on smaller and smaller scales. So in simple words, it's a fractal. The space-time near the near the origin, where the black hole would have liked to be formed, is a fractal. If you zoom and magnify it by a factor of 30, say, then you get the same space. So this is one problem. That's another problem. I explained it very briefly. On the face of it, these are two different problems. Here we have black hole formation. It's a time evolution problem. Here it's a static problem. We don't have black hole formation. We have some transition between black hole and black string. So on the face of it, it looks different. However, there are some similarities. Both of them are equations of GR in two dimensions. Here it is the time coordinate and the R coordinate because of the spherical symmetry, while here it was R and Z. And actually when you look at it, but this requires more time, you see that it is both equations, the equations are exactly the same. It's the same matter content that appears, the same action, therefore the same equations of motion. And then you say, okay, if I have the same equations, then the solutions must be related.
Sorry, when you say the same, we're thinking of Chopwick scaling with the scalar field or with?
We're thinking about Chopwick, about this problem. So the action here is integral of Ricci plus d phi squared.
Okay, you're comparing this with your...
with that, which was pure gravity. Right.
Okay.
So you're asking how come they have the same matter content? No.
What since they have the same matter content?
Okay.
Because it's hyperbolic and this is elliptic.
That's right. So this one is time evolution while this one is static. That's right. So the relation will involve two things. So this is on the Chopwick side. On the merger side, the matter content is G mu nu in d dimensions. Because the spacetime is static, I can reduce over time. And that gives me G mu nu in d minus 1 plus a scalar field because of the because it is static rather than stationary, there is no vector field. Well, the scalar field is nothing but GTT, right? So GTT goes like e to the 2 phi. So this is the relation between this phi and Chopwick's phi. So Chopwick's problem can be thought of as in one dimension less, and that scalar corresponds to the scalar of the GTT in this one. And actually, if you look at the action, then the action here, which is the Einstein-Hilbert action in D dimensions, when you reduce it, it becomes e to the 2 phi r in D plus d phi squared up to constants, and then you do a Weyl scaling which exactly kills this. So it turns out that that it is exactly the same action. Okay, so now phi is just defined like this. When you write the action, you get exactly this. So after Weyl scaling, it becomes just r plus d phi squared. The e to the 2 phi disappears from both, so it's exactly the same action, therefore exactly the same equations of motion. So now you say, aha, it's the same action, but not quite. There's one difference, which is the signature. Here space-time is Lorentzian, and here it's Euclidean. Okay, so you say, okay, it will be an analytic continuation, and that requires actually a little time to understand what it means here. But there is a difference in analytic continuation. It's the same equations, but after analytic continuation. And then the second issue is boundary conditions. And there you have to analyze quite carefully the boundary conditions. But the most important thing is that you look at boundary conditions which require scaling or self-similarity. In this solution we saw, or in this thinking about the merger transition, we saw that if you look near the singularity, near the pinching point, you lose all information about what happened, about things that are happening far away, about the black hole or the black string. You just zoom over there, so all scales get lost, and you expect to see self-similarity or scaling symmetry. Similarly, I told you, but for the same reason, in the Chopwick critical solution, you also get self-similarity. So this is the most important boundary condition. It's a boundary condition in the direction towards the singularity. So you can think of it as a boundary condition in the direction towards the singularity. It's a scaling symmetry. However, there is also one boundary condition which is different between the two. So I will not show that now. So the problems are very close. There is analytic continuation, boundary condition, same equations, one boundary condition the same, the one that has to do with periodicity, with log periodicity, with scaling, and the other boundary condition, which I'm not showing now, is different.
Is what is the analog of Kohn's solution in Chopwick case? It's Chopwick?
No, this is the CSS solution. So there you can also write down, I think there is a Roberts solution, which is CSS. Okay? So CSS and DSS are terms from the Chopwick language. It's either continuous self-similarity or discrete self-similarity. So either a cone has continuous self-similarity, you scale it by any number, you get the same. Or discrete self-similarity means, in simple words, wiggly cone. Okay? So the double cone obviously is a cone, so it has CSS. So it's not. So then one of the interesting questions is whether there are DSS solutions over there. I didn't show you any, and I don't know of any, but I'm looking for them. This is one of the interesting questions, because here we have discrete DSS, and here we don't.
Is that difference DSS versus CSS related to your difference in boundary conditions that you mentioned?
That's not clear. There is a difference in boundary conditions, and you cannot, I don't know, that in itself doesn't tell you yet, because that the boundary, these are boundary conditions, so to speak, in a different direction. So maybe they affect this outcome, or maybe they don't. Yeah, but they don't prescribe it.
Yeah, is Robert's solution or Robertson's solution you mentioned in the Chopwick case, which is completely self-centered, this...
I hope I'm right.
Is this something which appears in the dynamical problem of scalar fields?
No, it does not. There it does not. I hope I'm exact on that. There, it's a solution that you can write down, but it does not appear in the time evolution because it is less stable. So the when you do the collapse wants to go to the attractor. So if you have a number of solutions, only one of them is the most attractive one. It's the one which is attractive to all initial conditions, which are exactly on the boundary between for black hole formation. So it's called attractor. It's called dimension one for initial condition space. Okay, so.
The other one appears only if you tune additional conditions.
There's no right, exactly. So there are important issues here of which one is more stable, and this we don't know yet. Actually, we can say certain things. We know, for instance, that analytic continuation completely destroys or changes issues of stability. And so, as if you look at a solution before or after analytic continuation, the stability issues which are important change. Why do they change? They change because, let's take a simple example for stability. Not in GR, but just the harmonic oscillator. So this is the stable harmonic oscillator, right? And it has a stable solution, x equals to zero. Now if I take t to it, I get another Lagrangian, half minus half x squared. By analytic continuation, x equals to zero is still a solution. But of course, it is now an unstable solution. Okay, so this is the simple reason why, when you do analytic continuations, you destroy various stability properties that you had. So presumably, with the merger boundary conditions, it is safe. It is good to work in Euclidean two-dimensional space. In the Chopwick boundary condition, it's good to work in the time evolution, in the Lorentzian signature.
Is this a really always so easy to trace back? I mean, if you know, why you analytic continuity is unstable, it's because you're starting from that stable or vice versa, something like that.
I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to do that. You're asking if you know what is the stability here, do I know what is the stability there? Perhaps it can be done, but I don't know how to do this. Except for this example.
And on the Chopwick side, something still happens at d equal 10?
Oh, so this was one of the... So there were a series of implications, which I don't have time to describe, but one of them was, let's if we see this interesting dimensional dependence on the merger side, let's study Chopwick on the other side. So at the time, we knew only about Chopwick at four dimensions, and there was also one experiment at six dimensions. And actually, at the time, there was even some coincidence that seemed to be too, that in hindsight, we didn't deserve it. So it seemed to, there was something working nicely. And then Yevgeny Sorkin and Jonathan Oren did the Chopwick problem for a range of dimensions. And they were able to measure for the first time the two scaling constants, delta and gamma, for dimensions from 4 to 11, I believe. Okay? And the question was whether something interesting will happen at 10, or actually 9, because it's one less. So there, nothing happened at 9. However, 11 is exactly the point where both these constants seem to reach some extremum point. So maybe something not as interesting, but something still interesting is happening there. But it wasn't easy. It doesn't allow me to use the word easy. But there were problems to doing this, the simulation in higher dimensions. It's not that they were ruled uninteresting. They're very interesting, but but it's a difficult numerical problem the higher d becomes.
Okay.
Okay, so we don't know. There might be something going on there, there might not, but it's clearly an interesting question to ask, how do these constants behave with D? Okay, so I explained the basic idea, actually went through, I think, most of the points there. Let's see if there is something more about implications that I want to say in conclusion. Before discussing the implications, I have to cite the wise words of the referee of this paper. This paper is long on buzzwords and short on physics, and therefore is rejected. And now we go to the implications. Well, one of them we just described. We also discussed the issue of whether we can see DSS on the merger, DSS behavior, discrete behavior on the merger side, and if so, whether we can find these scaling constants. Well, you can ask, one of them is defined whether it's DSS or CSS, so it's not known. So this has to be found. And the other one, if it's DSS, should exist also. So there are several things to measure and to find out, which we didn't do yet. We're actively trying now, but we don't have it yet. So I think these are the major implications. And just a final comment. You notice that there are these words, scaling constants, scaling. So everyone is reminded of quantum field theory and the second order phase transition. And this analogy has not escaped us. But that's very speculative and we'll not discuss over here. So I think I will stop here. Okay. So in the static case, we saw the role that cones play. Static case means that the only the space time is actually R and Z. It's now erased. In the time evolution, it's of course you have one additional parameter, time. So it becomes a three-dimensional problem, and we don't know precisely what to expect. There might very well be some singularity, in which case you expect some scaling behavior near the singularity. But we don't know. For instance, not long ago, Chopik tried to generalize this problem from spherical collapse to cylindrical collapse. This exactly makes it from a two essential variables, essential dimension of space-time, to three, because now you have, right, you have R, Z, and T. And there we found a much more complicated behavior. It wasn't a single singularity. It wasn't completely clear, but it seemed like there was a fractal of singularities, or the singularities divided from one to two, and then perhaps more. It's not clear, actually. So the behavior there could be much more complicated. It could be that there is a single singularity with some kind of scale invariant solution around it, but it could be much more interesting, and this is beyond us at the moment.
So
if I understand correctly, you want to take the static solution.
Yes.
Exactly this one, exactly the one which is on the boundary.
The one at the cross.
Right. Right. So, okay. So this question is equivalent to the following question. You stand on the top of a mountain, and there, far away, there are two valleys, and you start falling. And where will I end up? It's really not a simple question. It depends in which direction you start falling, and normally this is a question which is much harder to answer. So it's relatively easy to identify all the tops of mountains and all the valleys. But to identify whether, given, and it depends also on the original direction that you take, right? So you may go like this, or you may go like this, or you may go like this. I I cannot tell.
In personal, in thinking about Irvin's question, how do you think the entropy of the cone solution compares to the entropy of the black hole and the black string at the same energy?
So when you say the cone solution, do you mean only the local solution or the global solution?
Well, I mean the global solution.
Okay.
It's not exactly a cone.
Okay, good. So this solution, which is locally near the singularity, a cone, how does the entropy compare? Well, we know that it is unstable. Well, I wasn't confirmed, but my
if, for example, the entropy of the other two, we'd be having a clear answer to Roberto's question.
No. Yeah, it should be below both of them. It's a mountain peak. And there are two valleys. Of course, it matters which valley is lower. So if a valley is lower, you may say maybe there is a higher probability that your bones end up there. But this is not necessarily, right? So this is the question of height. But I think probably true that you're above both of them, although I'm not sure if I can be certain.
Local conservation should be a local minimum of the entropy along this line as well, then.
A local minimum along this line? Why?
This dotted line is always below entropy compared to the two others based on the numerical data that's
used. Maybe because of some symmetry reason in five dimensions, then it has to be a minimum, but. I don't see. It's hard to know. Well, actually, we have a plot. We have a plot of the entropy going around here, provided by Toby and also Hideaki, I think. So one can look how it behaves and compare it. This data is available, but I don't know. Well, it's more unstable. This is the basic fact, but I'm not sure what beyond this.
Coming back to your analogy between the scaling and the double cone,
yeah.
In the chocolate problem, there are systems where you can assume additional symmetry, right? Where you can assume the continuous self-similarity from the start,
okay,
and solve the equations numerically.
This is in a having different matter content, I assume.
Slightly different. So, I mean, okay. Still basically sort of a scalar field with some strange coupling, perhaps.
Okay. So sometimes it is DSS, and sometimes it's CSS,
right.
The critical solution.
So in this
solution.
Case, you're assuming, for instance, the existence of scaling symmetry, right? So you assume the homothetic filling vector exists, and then you try to solve the problem.
No. It's not I'm not sure I agree with this hypothesis. Shall I comment now, or do you want to finish first? Because
I mean, I don't know what the point of your comment is.
Yeah.
Let me finish mine.
Okay. Yeah.
So you can assume this, solve the equations, and find by construction, if you will, the existence of a CSS solution.
Right.
So my question is, can you do this on this side, right? If this analogy really holds, right? Can you assume the existence of an additional symmetry? I don't know. You seem to make an implication that there's CSS on this side, DSS over here, and vice versa.
Right.
If you assume an additional symmetry over here, can you then try and do a similar sort of thing? Can you then solve the equations? But now with the added, complication that, for instance, you have some sort of chi dependence or something like that.
Yeah.
So have you done that? And what's
Understudy.
It's understudy. Okay.
Yeah. So there are no results yet. It's not clear. But a CSS solution I already have. But we're looking also for a DSS solution, and indeed, as you say, there are various ways of constructing such a solution. But somehow, well, it's too early, I would say, at the moment, so I cannot comment on that. I don't know.
I mean, I don't know if the difference in boundary conditions provides you an obstruction or something, but I mean, it seems like a first thing to try.
Yes, yes, yes. You can definitely do that. And if anybody is interested, you can discuss it.
Well, all right, thank you very much.
Sorry for keeping you so long.